So we are in 1 Timothy. We are in chapter 2. And if you were here last week, you know that we had made it down. We were looking at verses 8 through the end of the chapter, through verse 15. And we had covered verse 8 pretty well. And we were talking about verses 9 and 10. And the topic that's been 9 and 10 is the attire of women. And what's mentioned, well, let's just read verses 9 and 10. In like manner also, that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is praiseworthiness with good works. And we had, if you remember, we had also looked at Peter makes some similar when he writes his letter in 1 Peter verses 1 through 6. Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they be won by the conduct of their wives, that they observe their your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Do not let your arranging the hair, wearing of gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart with the gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. And Peter talked about the attire of women, and how Paul here is, you know, we look at these passages, have heard the same thing where some have used these passages to talk about how women should not wear provocative clothing, and that's not the point of the passage here. The point of the passage was that wealth, and that was really what both Paul and Peter were getting at, that these things they were doing were sort of an outward show of how wealthy they were. And we know that to be that the country is at when Paul is writing had wealth. We've read in 1 Timothy 6 where there's some instructions to. So that's the point that's being made here, is that don't flaunt your wealth. Dress. That is really the only other topic that I wanted to get addressed with this particular scriptures, is what are we to make of this today? So I didn't look around, but if not today, there have been times when ladies have come to services. Maybe someone today is wearing pearls. I'm going to guess that nearly all of us are wearing gold. Down at your left hand, and you're married, your ring is probably made of gold. So what are we today supposed to? So I guess really the question is, is it wrong for women to wear pearls and wear gold? So that's the question.
I agree with you on the wealth thing. You know, if you have money, you're not supposed to profess that you're not supposed to show it off, just like Christ talked about. You're not supposed to treat someone that obviously is wealthy. You're not supposed to treat them better than you are a poor person. But I think it's the difference between how women of the church, women of God, are to look different than women of the world, in the fact that some women are immodest. And one of the things back then was prostitutes were very easy to observe because of the way they dressed and made themselves up. And in some places today, they are too. And the woman of the church is not to look anything like that as a man.
Okay.
It applies to not only the wealth, but also the modesty.
Oh, yeah. Some things we can take from this outside of just the specific thing about not flaunting your wealth. I mean, the issue that dressed in modest apparel with propriety,
you know, in God's eyes, it can't be the same.
Yeah. And
because they're so radically different.
Yeah. That is a that's a topic that is an interesting study. I guess we'll leave it at that they're supposed to dress modestly, and there's probably another time for us to talk about what that is, because Mike's right. There certainly is a wide variation in what constitutes modesty. One other thing that I want to point out, when you look at both of the passages in Peter and here in 1 Timothy, the message is pretty clear that what is supposed to be beautiful about a woman? Is it supposed to be how they look on the outward? No, it's supposed to be the inner person. And remember what God says to Samuel when Samuel is choosing the next king of Israel. Don't look on his outward appearance. God looks at the heart. And so, in some ways, that's the same kind of message here. And I think that's a good way for us to look at it. If we find ourselves, or if we can look at it, well, if you're a woman and you find yourself dressing for show, then I think that's the way that we make application here. That the issue is not specifically gold and braided hair and pearls. The issue is, when you dress, what is the purpose of your dress? Are you trying to flaunt something? If that's the case, then that's something that we should avoid.
I think that's probably the principle that carries over no matter what the time is. As Dad said, modesty in our definition of it changes all the time. And so there has to be a constant that we can anchor back to. I mean, the things that men and women wear today will probably be considered immodest 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you go back thousands of years ago. And so you can't really go on that quite as much as...
Just an interesting side note. You know, we talk a lot about modesty in women, but as it relates to modesty and men, there's an interesting passage in John. If you remember that when Jesus has died and he's appeared to the apostles once, and the apostles then go fishing. We talked about this story in VBS. They're out fishing and they see this man on the shore, and he communicates with them. And when they realize, when Peter realizes that it's Jesus, what does he do? Does he take it off, or does he put it on? Is that right? I may have had this backwards here. I thought he put it on. Well, I'm going to be confused here. Yeah. So look at John chapter 21. Because you would think, right, the initial thought is, oh, well, he took his outer garment off and jumped into the water because he didn't want to get it wet. But that's actually not what happens. John chapter 21, verse 7. Therefore, the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." Now, when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he had removed it, and plunged into the sea. I mean, it's sort of backwards from what we would think, but I don't know if this is what the issue is, but it appears to me that maybe Peter here in going and meeting with the Lord wanted to make sure he was fully dressed. And maybe that's a modesty issue, maybe it's not. All right, let's move on, unless there's other comments about this. Let's look at verses 11 through the end of the chapter. And I'll mention again here something I mentioned last week, that... A topic that I don't think is difficult to understand, but I think is a topic that sometimes can be, I don't know, maybe presented in an insensitive way, or maybe can kind of get some feathers ruffled. And that's not my intention. My intention here is just to look at this passage as Paul commanded Timothy. Paul tells Timothy, "Now the purpose of this commandment is love from a pure heart, from a good conscience and sincere faith." And when we look at this passage, I think we need to have that same kind of attitude. So let's look at verses 11 through the end of the chapter. "Let a woman learn in silence with all submission, and I do not permit a woman to teach or have authority over man, but to be in silence. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing, if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control." Paul here gives some commandments to Timothy, but it's not the first time that Paul has given these commandments. Paul makes a similar statement in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. So let's go look at it, and those two passages in combination, I think, help us to understand what Paul is saying. So Paul here, this is later in life, in Timothy. He's writing to Timothy, who is with the congregation at Ephesus. Paul, earlier in his life, writes this command to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 14. verses 34 and 35. Those are just the two verses we'll look at now. Let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive, as the law also says. If they want to learn something, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it is shameful for women to speak in church. Now, to me, when I look at these passages, I don't see that the commands are difficult to understand. You know, there's times where Paul or other writers of the New Testament, they speak in a way that, well, you got to really dig into that to understand. But that's not the case here. It's just very direct. And the issue is, there's really two issues here. The second issue, which I think is maybe the overarching issue, is that women are not to have authority over a man, but to be submissive. And then the second, more specific issue is that they are to be silent. So let's ask this first question. When is it appropriate for a woman to be in silence? Well, the context of both of these passages, to me, is very clear. So in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and 1 Corinthians 14, I think we can look at the context there and see that both of these passages are talking about the assembly. So let's go to 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 14 and 15. So in 1 Corinthians 3, 14 and 15, Paul says this, "These things I write to you." So when he says, "these things," well, it's this letter. He's writing this letter, "these things I write to you, though I hope to come to you shortly. But if I am delayed, I write so that you may know how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the church." So what was the purpose in Paul writing to Timothy? He wanted to be there, but he thinks maybe I'm going to be delayed in getting there. So in the interim, I'm going to write you a letter so that you know what? How to conduct yourself in the house of God. So in the assembly, that's the issue. Okay. In 1 Corinthians chapter 14, we read verses 34 and 35. If you go up to verse 26, we find it said, "How then is it, brethren, whenever you come together, you each have a psalm, has a teaching, has a tongue, has a revelation, has interpretation. Let all things be done for edification." So in both situations, once in 1 Corinthians before the comment, and then in 1 Timothy after the comment, it's specifically talking about the assembly. Now, knowing that Paul is giving these commands relative to the assembly, I think helps us understand some other issues that we have that often get brought up with this particular topic. And that is, namely, women in the first century were given spiritual gifts with the expectation of using them. In Acts chapter 2, Peter quotes a prophecy from Joel that clearly tells us, I mean, there's no denying that what Peter is saying is that women would be given spiritual gifts. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul gives some instructions to women regarding prayer and prophecy. And we know that Philip's daughters, what were Philip's daughters? He had four virgin daughters who were, what, prophets. So, I mean, there's no denying that women had spiritual gifts. And if they were given these gifts but not allowed to use them in the assembly, well, when could they use them? Well, the answer is simple. They could use them at other places outside of the assembly. And we have examples of that. Remember Aquila and Priscilla, right? They took Apollos aside and privately taught him. And it's very clear that it's both Aquila and Priscilla. It's not Aquila just teaching. No, it's Aquila and Priscilla. Paul also gives Titus some instructions in Titus chapter 2 that older women are to teach the younger women. And then just one other interesting example that I think helps with this is consider the example in the Old Testament, which is one example in the Old Testament, of Deborah. Well, what do we know about Deborah? She was a prophetess. And yet it appears that she did her work in a very different way than all of the other prophets. In Deborah chapter 4, verses 4 through 5, we find that how did Deborah operate? Well, Deborah was, verse 5 says, she would sit under a palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. A little bit, I see this as a little bit different than how the other prophets work. many other prophets that we read about, they're going places. They're presenting themselves very publicly, but Deborah didn't operate that way. She was located in a place that the children of Israel knew, and they came to her, and I get this appearance that there is private work happening here. And so, to me, when I look at this command, when it says in 1 Timothy chapter 2, it says women are to be silent, I see that this is talking about the assembly. There are other times when it's completely appropriate for women to speak and use the talents that God has given them. But in the assembly, Paul has, through Paul and the Holy Spirit, has said that women are to be silent. So the question becomes, why? Why is it that God has said this? Well, the first thing that I want to say is that I really hesitated to even bring up this when talking about the issue of the pearls and gold and braided hair, because one of the things about that is that was a cultural thing to show wealth. And so in some ways, what I'm getting ready to tell you is that verses 9 and 10, we can look at that and understand that there's some cultural components there. And so some will look at verses 11 through the end of the chapter and then also say, well, there's a cultural issue here. That at that time that women were silent because it was the cultural thing. But that's not the explanation or the reason for this issue. That Paul's reasoning for why women are to be silent in the assembly sort of transcends culture. And what is it? What's the reason why women are to be silent? Well, the first is that God has instituted a hierarchy. That there is, for lack of a better word, a chain of command. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 3, Paul says, "But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God." We can look at other passages and put children in there and understand that children are to be obedient to their parents. So when you look at sort of the hierarchy, you have God, then Christ, then man, then woman, and then children. That's the hierarchy that God has established. And so in verse 13 of 1 Timothy chapter 2, the very first reason why a woman is to be silent and to not have authority over a man, for Adam was formed first, then Eve. For, because. Here is the reason. The first reason is because of hierarchy. Now, I find it also interesting that the very next thing that says is, "And Adam was not deceived, but the woman, being deceived, fell into transgression." So Paul goes back to that very first sin. That's another reason. I think it's related to Adam being formed first, because when we go back to that sin, remember the punishment that was given to Eve, and therefore all women, in Genesis chapter 3, verse 16. "To woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception and pain. You shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." So one of the punishments associated with the sin of Eve was that she would need to be in subjection to her husband, that he would rule over her. So that's the first issue. The first issue that Paul, the first reason why women are to be silent and are not permitted to have authority over men is that there's a hierarchy that God has established. The second is order. Not order as in hierarchy, but order as in a lack of confusion. Now, 1 Timothy doesn't discuss this, but the reason we read 1 Corinthians 14 is because that's the issue in 1 Corinthians 14. The context of Paul's message in 1 Corinthians 14, when he tells women to be silent, is maintaining order. Apparently, the assemblies at the church at Corinth were very confusing and full of disorder. And it appears that what Paul is saying here, his command regarding women in 1 Corinthians 14, in part, it's part of God's plan just to maintain order. Let all things be done decently and in order. And so when I look at this, I don't think it's hard for us to understand. I think it's difficult for us to put into practice. And that is that when we assemble together, the message that God gives us is clear. He doesn't permit a woman to speak, and they're not to have authority over men or to teach. So those are the issues. And I want to open it up to comments, see if there's some other thoughts on this, and then I do want to spend a lot more time looking at verse 15, because I think verse 15 is really interesting. So before we move to verse 15, are there some comments about verses 11 through 14?
We're going to miss Gwen.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Gwen would I know Gwen would have a different view on this, and I know there is different opinion on this. And like I said, when I almost didn't teach 1 Timothy, just because I don't want this to be a point of contention. I want you to know how I feel about it, and if you have a different point of view, now's the opportunity to bring that up.
I'll just say one thing, and that is I'm glad that you did not dodge it, because if we start dodging the scriptures, we're in trouble, whatever the issue may be. The other thing I might just say is just maybe on clarification, you know, we have women who teach boys in class. But, you know, my understanding of this and my belief on this is that they're boys. They're not men. Okay? And if they were men, then I don't think that would be right.
Yeah.
Just from these various scriptures that we've read here. But yeah. When whatever age that is or whatever level of maturity, when a boy becomes a man, I don't think that he should be in a class with a woman teaching that.
I do agree. I think one interesting thing about that is, to whom does God give the command to educate children about the Lord? Who's given that command? Fathers, yeah. And I agree that I think that having women teach children, I don't see an issue with that. But I would say that the ultimate responsibility lies on the father. The father is responsible for your family.
Yeah, I just might follow up. It might be that, you know, some women would know more than a man about what they're talking about. But that doesn't change the chain of command. And if that's true, then shame on the man. He needs to learn.
Well,
or maybe he's a new convert and just hasn't reached that status yet. But, you know, we still have to follow God's command.
So, now Peter doesn't talk about this issue of women being silent, but Peter talks about the other issue that we just talked about. But in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1, what's the issue there? The issue appears to be that a wife is converted, but the husband is not. And we have some commands about that. There are going to be situations where the wife is far more knowledgeable about God's will than the man is, the husband is. But that doesn't negate the command of God that women be submissive to their husbands. In the end, we're all submissive to someone. All of us are submissive to the elders. We all are submissive to Christ. So it's just about understanding our role, our what our responsibility is. Eddie.
We have two grandmothers on both sides of the family. They were members of the church. Both my grandfathers won. One was Baptist, and I'm not sure. I think the other one had on my mother's side. But my grandmothers taught me, not in the church, but outside the church, basically. That's my thing.
Yeah.
You know, they brought them into the church.
Yeah, so are we supposed to start calling you Timothy? Because, I mean, remember who Paul is writing to here. Paul is writing to a man who was taught by his mother and grandmother. And that is a wonderful example of how this example, you know, of what we're talking about can work. All right, let's look at verse 15, because I think verse 15 is... yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with pretty much all everything you said. I think what we have to really do is look at that word silent in the Greek, because in some places it's, in the ESV, it's translated quiet.
Quiet.
When you look at that word, it's saying there seemed to be a tendency for the women just to kind of get really overbearing in their talking. And he's telling them, and I think we look at verse 12, really tells us what the word silent means. It means to be in submission. It's talking about submissiveness to the man's rule and authority, and the woman is never to usurp that. We know that. That's very straightly taught. I think we get these different ideas because we take that word "side" sometimes as just absolute. Well, then that would mean the woman couldn't even sing.
We certainly know that it's not absolute. We know that.
To bolster what Blaine was saying in that chapter 3 of 1 Peter, the emphasis is a gentle and quiet spirit. Mm-hmm. A gentle and quiet spirit. Not one that's... And I get the impression that in Corinth was a very idolatrous place. And a lot of the women were leaders in the idolatrous worship. Is my understanding, and so some of that carried over, I think.
Actually, that was the comment I was going to make in reference to Dwayne's message. In 1 Corinthians 14, that is exactly what's going on. If you look at really chapter 11 all the way through, I don't know, 15 or 16, what you see is that you get this picture that when the congregation at Corinth got together, there were women who were given spiritual gifts, and they were using them in the assembly, but they, along with men too, appear to be using their gifts in a way that was creating disruptions. And that's not what God wants. That's why there's the passage about you don't speak in tongues unless there's an interpreter. Don't prophesy unless, you know, there's just all things are to be done decently in order. That's the message there. All right, let's get to verse 15, because of all the passages we're going to talk about in 1 Timothy chapter, or all of really the whole book, verse 15 just, man, this is just confusing to me. And I don't have an answer, so I'm hoping to get an answer. Verse 15, "Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control." All right, so let's just ask the question, what does this mean? What does it mean when it says she will be saved in childbearing? I have some thoughts, but before I pollute you with my thoughts, I want to know what you think. Okay, that's my first point here. Let's talk about what it doesn't mean. Let's get the easy one out of the way. It certainly doesn't. There is no other place where we can turn to that says, if you have children, you'll be saved. That's not the plan of salvation. And so it doesn't mean that. And it also doesn't mean that women who don't have children won't be saved. It can't mean that, because if you look at the other passages, that doesn't make sense. So we got the easy one out of the way. We know what it doesn't mean. So now, what does it mean?
That word "saved," I don't think it's the same as would be, be baptized and be saved. I don't think it's that word.
All right, so
it seems to be more heal, preserve, to deliver, to protect. That kind of has that idea. So, in talking about God, what God's the punishment He put upon a woman, they can kind of be protected from that or delivered from that.
All right. So Dwayne touched on one perspective that people have on this passage, is that word "saved" there does not mean salvation. And I certainly think that's a good explanation. I'll say this, Dwayne, I don't know if it's right or not. I just don't know what the right answer here is. But if you had an opportunity to attend the Midwest Bible Campout, Rick Sparks was asked to talk about, I can't remember what his topic was, but he talked about this verse in particular and spent quite a bit of time on it. And if I understand what he was trying to say correctly, his understanding is that this passage deals with influence over the church. So, you know, if you look at this in context, relative to the preceding passages about limitations on women speaking and a limitation on their authority in the assembly, that without a voice, some women may feel that they have no influence over the church. Well, that wasn't the point Rick was trying to make. I don't know. We would say the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world, right? So there is an influence in being a mother, that you're going to have influence over your children, and then therefore you're going to have some influence over the church. I think that was the message that Rick was getting at. And so maybe that's what this means.
However, the verse does go ahead and say, if
Yeah, who's they?
Their kids or her?
Yeah, I think it's the children.
The children.
I think it's the children. I mean, an argument could be made they, but the issue there is the pronoun nevertheless she, that's singular, and then the next pronoun they is plural, and that's not usually how the Bible writes, where it's if it's talking about the she, then it's going to be singular again. So I think they, it refers back to children. All right, so that's one explanation. Do we have another explanation? I think there's probably two other explanations.
Well, one could be that if she's a faithful Christian, that she will not die when she has a child. We're just talking about childbearing.
Oh.
Why is the word childbearing? Why did he use that if it didn't have something to do with having a baby? You know, that's one kind of thought. And, you know, some people might think, well, that's ridiculous. Well, maybe it is, maybe it's not. You know, how many people have died because they were baptized in icy water?
I don't know. It was pretty cold when I was baptized, and I'm still here.
Well, I would challenge anyone to, you know, say they know of someone. Or maybe even caught a cold. I don't know. Yeah. I'm not saying that's the answer.
Yeah.
But it, you know, I agree with you that it's kind of a strange verse. In,
so, can't,
it has something to, it appears to have something to do with having a baby.
Well, so one explanation that directly related to that issue of childbearing, when we look at the preceding verses, what's being described there? Well, we oftentimes talk of the preceding verses as the role of women in the church. Well, there are things that women can do that men cannot, and vice versa. And one thing that women can do biologically that men cannot is have children. And so some argue that this phrase "saved in childbearing" is a figure of speech, a figure of speech that is using a part to represent a whole. So an example might be, if I were to say, "Hey, let's go eat," well, you understand that we also, in going to eat, we're also going to drink as well. You know, we eat and drink. We don't say, "Let's go eat and drink." We just say, "Let's go eat." And so some look at this and say, well, this is a figure of speech. And since childbearing is exclusively a role of women, some believe that childbearing represents a part of the whole, and the whole being the role of a wife and mother in God's plan. And so those that look at this that way basically are saying, if you do your job, right, if you fill your role, then you will be saved. So that's how one folks look at it. They say, well, it's not really about childbearing specifically. It's just that's the role of women. And I don't know that I agree with that, but that was one that I looked at that in some ways made some sense. The third thing that people say is that this is related to salvation. They look at the passage and say that therefore, or nevertheless, she, that word she is referencing back to Eve. So in verse 15, the pronoun she refers to Eve, going back to verses 13 and 14, as opposed to all women going back to verse 12. In looking at this, there's another word that is dropped from that it would be translated the, and so if, I know, I like Young's literal translation at times. And so if you were to read this from Young's literal translation, it would say, "And she shall be saved through the childbearing if they remain in faith, love, sanctification, and sobriety." Did you hear that? She shall be saved through the childbearing, almost as if to make it one act given to Eve. So the argument here is that childbearing is specifically speaking of Eve's childbearing, so that through Eve we find that Christ is born, and therefore all salvation, all people have salvation. So that's kind of the third explanation. I don't know what the right answer here is. It's a passage that is a little difficult for me to understand. So I know what it doesn't mean. I guess that's maybe good enough. Other comments about this?
I think that kind of goes along with the whole verse, though, like what you're saying, because sense of the maternal duties that the woman has, and that is to teach the children and to then, you want to teach them so they will have this faith, love, and holiness and self-control.
Yep. All right, so next week we're going to jump into chapter 3. And we, as a congregation, not so long ago, spent quite a bit of time talking about chapter 3. Chapter 3 deals with the qualifications for elders and deacons. That's really verses 1 through 13. So what I don't want to do is I don't want to go through each of those qualifications in great detail. So take some time over the next next week and read chapter 3, look at those qualifications, and we're going to pick out a few interesting things. We're not going to look at every qualification, but if there is one in particular that you do want to look at, we'll spend some time with it. But what I intend to do is just pick out a couple relative to both elders and deacons. All right, we'll take a short break.